Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Shabbat Shalom, everybody. I'm going to begin with this. Ha-Elohim asher diber mekedem yamim rabot uvderachim rabot el ahavot ve'ad ha-Nehim. In the past, God spoke to our fathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. Now, in the end of days, God has spoken to us by the Son, whom God appointed the heir of all things, and through whom he made the universe. A few weeks ago, on January 4th, I began teaching a series on the book of Hebrews. Of course, Hebrews, sometimes we call it the book of Messianic Jews, because Jews don't typically call each other Hebrews. It's a little strange. But last message was all about introduction, and we're going to continue this series today and every other week for a period of time until we get through the whole book. Last time was the time of introduction. We discussed the historical context of the book, what kind of literature it is, when it was written, who wrote it, to whom it was written to. We unpacked what was going on in the community at that time and how that would, in that context, would influence how we would read the book. And that message is on the website. So if you'd like to kind of keep along and you missed it, you can go back and keep up with this whole series. Now, I'm excited to actually jump into the text today, though we're only going to get through the first two verses. We're going to open this book up and really get into the nitty-gritty of it. The beginning is really an incredible beginning. It's like an epic drama. It's like Star Wars. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Ba-ba-ba-bum, bum, ba-ba-ba-bum, bum. God spoke to our fathers through the prophets in many times and in various ways. Now, we don't know who the author is. We argued in our last message that reading Hebrews is like listening in on a powerful Messianic Jewish sermon in the first century. We covered the context last time, that it's really essential for us to understand this first century context and what the author intended for its literal meaning to be so that we can understand this book. So as we move into the first few verses, we need to really grasp this because it opens up the entire book. So a little review. If you can imagine, you're back in the scene. It was late 50s, early 60s. The heart of the book of Acts is going on right now. The disciples, we read, met daily in the temple courts to pray together, to teach, to encourage each other. They would speak in the temple to others. They would pray for the sick, and people would be healed. In Acts 6, we read that many of the Kohanim, the priests, became obedient to the faith. Now, of course, the Kohanim didn't change status when they became obedient to the faith, did they? They continued to serve as priests, and we might imagine them gathering together after the temple service was complete along with the disciples. It says thousands and thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people who were zealous for the Torah are becoming believers in the Messiah in first century Judaism inside of the temple. We read in Acts 27, it mentions that the followers gathered on the first day of the week. And just as a little bit of a side note, that wasn't because they had rejected the Jewish Sabbath and replaced it with Sunday worship, as many later readers read into the text. Remember, the Jewish day begins in the evening. So they were at the temple all day for Shabbat services, and then they would meet for the close of Shabbat, maybe like a first century Havdalah hangout. I say that because Ruach House is leading a Havdalah hangout tonight. Kind of a similar kind of a thing. Now, we know that it was referring to the night and not to the morning because the next verse says that Paul kept on speaking all night. And then Eutychus is sitting on the upper window. He falls asleep. He falls down. He dies. When he hits the ground, Paul comes, resurrects him from the dead. And then it says Paul continued to speak until morning. It didn't bother him that no one was sleeping. And I don't know if they had coffee in those days or not. But anyway, they were passionate. That's what I want to get. Can you imagine staying all night to listen to Paul before he goes off on his next adventure? So I'm painting a picture for you. As their numbers grew, followers were arrested by the leaders of the temple, some leaders, not all the leaders, and put in prison. They were flogged. They were told to stop teaching about Yeshua and to disperse. But they pressed on, and Stephen was stoned under the oversight of Shaul himself, and before he had his own Jewish awakening to the Messiah. Yaakov, the tzaddik, otherwise known as James, beloved of the wider Jewish community, the head of the Messianic Jewish community in Jerusalem, was brutally martyred. And if you can imagine, you were there in the face of growing pressures to acquiesce or to be forced out of the temple. Imagine your friend Stephen was stoned. You saw it. Some of your Messianic Jewish brothers and sisters give in and begin to turn away from Yeshua. Others start to distance themselves, no longer attending the gatherings, fearing that their faith might be discovered. Some may have asked, why can't I just believe in him on the inside so that I won't be ostracized from my temple service, which I love, or excluded from my Jewish brothers and sisters? After all, you know, Yeshua loved the temple. Surely he wouldn't want me to jeopardize my temple worship. He grieved over the temple. He worshiped in the temple. Maybe I can be a Messianic Jew in secret. Tensions are high. You're gathered with hundreds, even thousands of other Messianic Jews and a prominent Messianic Jewish leader who held significant apostolic authority begins a message of exhortation to the people. And with urgency in his voice, he begins, "In the past, God spoke to our forefathers." That's the book of Messianic Jews. The first verses are the thesis of the entire message, the main exhortation that the author wants his hearers to hear. And then the rest of the 13 chapters are carefully articulated Jewish arguments to support this thesis. Now, what is he saying? To understand these two verses in light of the context, we need to first go back and understand how they have been traditionally read later on, which we're suggesting is reading later anachronistic ideas into the text that we talked about last week. So let's look at how these verses have been traditionally understood. This is the NIV reading. NIV is great in a lot of ways. In this one, they kind of pick up on one of these traditional readings. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times in various ways, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by the Son. Now, the traditional reading of this passage goes something like this. In the old days, God spoke to us through the Old Testament, the Jewish patriarchs, the Jewish prophets, and the Jewish laws. But now, a new era has dawned. The old is replaced, and God speaks to us through the Son. The past era is associated with the Jewish religion and the Jewish people. The new era is associated with the Christian church as a religion set apart from the Jewish people. And so when I refer to Christian church in this context, I'm not referring to all the people in the church today, but I'm referring to the institution of a religion that's set apart from the Jewish people. So a Jew who becomes a follower of Yeshua converts from Judaism to Christianity. He's no longer a Jew. The two become mutually exclusive categories later on. And this is drawn from these first two verses, among some other places. Again, not speaking about the whole church of today, and certainly not individual Christians, our brothers and sisters in Messiah. I'm speaking about a theology. It's a theology. And we need to understand this theology because it's how Hebrews has been understood and is widely understood today so that we can bring it back into its original context and help people to understand it in a new way and break down some of these barriers that have been created. Now, the popular contemporary commentary in the NIV Study Bible says this: the letter of the Hebrews is addressed to the Jewish converts familiar with the Old Testament who are being tempted to revert back to Judaism or to Judaize the gospel. One of the mainline commentaries today. Now, what does Judaize the gospel even mean? I mean, as if Yeshua's good news was not Jewish good news, right? Well, of course, the commentary then cites the term Judaizers in Galatians. But this reading of Galatians also neglects the historical context of the letter. Again, reading anachronistic anti-Jewish theology into Paul. Paul's Judaizers were not Jews who converted from Judaism to Christianity and were reverting back to Judaism. He uses the term Judaizers in Galatians to refer to a theology that required non-Jewish Gentile followers to formally convert and become Jews in order to be saved. You see the difference in theology here? Totally different. He's not writing to Jews at all. Paul follows the Jerusalem Council's decision in Acts 15, where the apostles unambiguously answer this question about the Gentiles. The answer is no, the Gentiles are now co-heirs to the same promise given to Abraham. They're not saved. They don't merit salvation by formal Jewish conversion. That's Galatians in a nutshell. The problem here is context. These commentators are operating out of a set of unbiblical and unhistorical assumptions that the tens of thousands of new Jewish followers of Yeshua in Jerusalem that we read about in Acts, that they converted to a new religion, leaving Judaism behind. That's the lens. Now, if you read Hebrews from that lens, then you'll think that these early Messianic Jews, we know were being tempted to leave Yeshua or turn away from Yeshua, we would read them as Jewish converts who once already left Judaism behind, but now they're tempted to go back to it, to the relics of the past. And so rather than reading Hebrews as a powerful message to the Jews, elevating the centrality of Yeshua within Judaism, it's read as a book to Christians about the superiority of the Christian religion above Judaism as a religion. See those two categories? This is called supersessionism, replacement theology. The church replaces the Jews as the new people of God. Now, two stark religious categories are created that will lead to centuries and centuries of pain. What happens is this theology, when it's put in the hands of men with power, was twisted into a dangerous idea for the Jews. The superiority of the Christian people over the Jewish people. Do you see the distinction? Now we have a better than people group, a worse than people group. That turns into Jews are like animals. That turns into persecution. That turns into history and history and history, thousands of years of death. Now again, let me qualify this. I'm not making categorical statements about Christianity. I'm challenging a theology. One that's so deeply embedded that faithful, godly people who are just trying to read their Bibles end up thinking this is what their Bibles say. And many, many Christians then and today fight against replacement theology. They love the Jewish people. They support the Messianic Jewish reawakening of Yeshua that we're a part of today. And things are changing because we're taking a second look at texts like Hebrews. And also, there's a lot of great things in the NIV Study Bible. There's a lot of good things there. Good and faithful people wrote it. But this one idea is not biblical. I would suggest Yeshua never taught it. The apostles challenged it. In the end of Acts chapter 21, Paul explicitly denies it, which we're going to unpack later on in our study of Hebrews. Now, what we need to do is we need to reread these first verses in Hebrews in the context of the whole biblical narrative. And from that lens, the first two passages come alive. The first two verses come alive. We find a more literal translation in the New American Standard Version. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son. Just a more literal translation might help us. To the prophets and to the fathers. What is he referring to? He's referring to the Tanakh. He's referring to the Tanakh. Tanakh, of course, stands for the Torah, the fathers or the patriarchs. It stands for Nevi'im, which is the prophets, and it stands for Ketuvim, which is other writings like Proverbs and Psalms. And this is the Hebrew Bible. This is the Hebrew Bible. Now, of course, we don't refer, this may be old hat to those of you who are been around for a while, but to anyone who's new, we don't refer to the Tanakh or the Hebrew Bible as the Old Testament. We don't really like to do that. It's older, sure, but it's not of lesser value. And from a Jewish perspective, the Tanakh is not really a testament at all. It's filled with all kinds of different types of literature. And so that name, the Old Testament, is developed in the womb of replacement theology. And I was actually recently listening to a Christian speaker. It was a good message in a lot of ways, but along the way, his replacement theology sunglasses, if you will, came on, and he said, "Now, when I say Bible, I mean New Testament. The old has lots of wisdom and stuff like that, but the new is where it's at because the new is the Son." Hebrews 1, misreading. Do you see? Flows right into it. Very poor theology, but it comes in part from this ancient misreading. Now, what's going on here isn't an either-or. God used to speak in those old ways, but now he speaks in this new way. Instead, it's the power of the revelation of the Son. It only stands because God has already spoken many times and in various ways. So, in the Torah, in Numbers, we read a similar argument. God made himself known to the prophets in visions and in dreams. But with Moses, God speaks mouth to mouth. God spoke in riddles with others, but with Moses, he speaks clearly. God speaking to Moses in a new way does not dawn a new era that ended those other forms of communication. And similarly here, he's saying, since long ago, God has always spoken through the Torah and the prophets. He has spoken in so many different ways and written in the scriptures. In these last days, he also speaks to us by the Son. What are the last days? The traditional interpretation sees them as this new messianic era that is dawned, the beginning of the New Testament that's in contrast to the old Jewish ways. But let's look at it more closely. Historically, there was no New Testament in the 50s and the 60s. Some of Paul's letters were circulating. Maybe some of the Gospels were in circulation, but the events in Acts, some of them hadn't even happened yet. The apostles believed they were living in the last days of the Tanakh. Yeshua spoke as if the first century was the last days. He says, "This generation will not pass away until all these things happen." Now imagine you're living in the 60s, the 0060s, not the 1960s. That's a whole different ballgame. But imagine you're part of this last generation that heard this message of disciples. You're the last generation when you heard Yeshua say, how urgent is this message? In one sense, we might say that they got it wrong. Here we are 2,000 years later, right? But Yeshua wasn't wrong. For God, 1,000 years is like a day. And a generation does not have to mean a literal age of a person, but an age. So you and I, we're still in the last days. The last days have been going on a long time. And they may continue a long time. But we better stay alert and ready because the kingdom is growing closer every day. What's the point? The last days in Hebrews is not the inauguration of a new era where Christianity replaces Judaism. It isn't a new era that replaces the old era. It's the same era. But the author is elevating Yeshua in the midst of it, in the midst of all the many ways that God speaks. So we might translate it something like this. God has spoken through the Torah and the prophets and in the scriptures in so many ways, and now in the first century, the heart of the end of days before the coming kingdom of God, he also speaks to us through his Son. And think about it. If the Son was the instigator of creation, if creation was created through the Son from the beginning of time, then it stands that all sorts of communication have been through the Son in some way all along. Prophecy, dreams, encounters with the Lord in the Tanakh. The Son was part of it all. But now, in the first century, he speaks clearly as if one mouth to mouth through the Son born in the flesh. So what's the big message in these last days? God has communicated clearly through Yeshua the message of the coming kingdom. That's Hebrews 1. Good news, the Besorah, The kingdom of heaven is at hand in the very person of Yeshua. And the author of Hebrews is saying to these first century Messianic Jews that Yeshua's words, his teachings, his action, his life, his example is Torah. The very word of God himself. Do you see how big that is? In the 50s and 60s, there's no Bibles with letters in red and, you know, the kind of like, you know what I mean? It wasn't there, right? Yeshua is Torah, is what he's saying. They're not just commentary. They're not just wisdom from a rabbi. They're the words of God himself. Hebrews is not trying to keep Jewish converts from backsliding into Judaism. It's so much more profound. The message is that the Son is the heartbeat of Judaism. And the key for this entire book in this passage is the early Jewish argument, principle of argumentation that dates back to Hillel, pre-first century, called Kol Vachomer, how much more so. And the way that works in this passage is like this. In the past, God has spoken in so many ways about all kinds of important things. How much more so should we listen to God now when he is speaking to us the urgent message of the kingdom, mouth to mouth by the Son himself? The very Son who is the heir of all things and through whom he created the world. How can you forsake Yeshua when he was there, when the very book of creation was written? How can you keep your faith quiet in the temple when the temple is a shadow of Messiah himself? These are not either or, but one completed part, like the heart in a body. Like as Rabbi Rich says, the diamond in the gold setting. And we want to remember that the last days of the first century are the same last days as the 21st century. And this means that this message is alive and relevant to us just as it was to them. And so, you know, for those of us who are Jewish, he's not an add-on to your Jewish faith. He's the core of your Jewish faith. And the bigger he becomes in your life, the more meaningful and important your Jewish identity becomes. And for every one of our Messiah's beloved disciples, for all of us, we don't usually fall away all or nothing, do we? We fall away, we drift away little by little. Community life in Messiah becomes less meaningful. Other things begin to loom larger, more distractions. Don't let Yeshua grow smaller and smaller in your life. Celebrate him with your brothers and sisters. That's what we did this morning. That's why I like to dance. Build and strengthen each other up in him. And hold fast to the faith that you have been given. Shabbat shalom.
In the mouths of the house of Israel, and may the descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those who know your name and study your Torah for Messiah.